holy ground, holy places. What defines holy ground? What defines a holy place? Is it what happened there? An event, a moment of God presence or God revelation, like what Moses experienced with the burning bush? Is ground hallowed by tragedy, by an epiphany? Does a holy place require a building or a monument to mark the spot? A little more than a year ago, I was in Israel and Palestine, and along with meeting Palestinian Christians and learning about the history and politics and struggles of that land, we also visited what religious pilgrims call holy sites. We went to the Tomb of the Patriarchs in Hebron. We went to Jacob's Well, went to the Western Wall, the Basilica of the Annunciation in Nazareth, the Church of the Nativity, built over the site of Jesus' birth in Bethlehem. We saw what is believed to be the Garden of Gethsemane. We went to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, built over the site where it is traditionally held that Jesus was crucified and then resurrected, and so on. And while I didn't specify this about every site that I just named in that short list, wherever there was an important holy moment from the biblical story, there was a church or a temple or a mosque built over that site to mark the spot. Sometimes whether that spot could be confirmed with historical accuracy or not. In one case, I had to chuckle to myself as I took note that along the road from Jerusalem down to Jericho, there is a Church of the Good Samaritan, built, I have to assume, to mark the spot where the Good Samaritan stopped to help the man who was beaten and left at the side of the road. How's that for a holy site? A church built to mark a sacred act in a parable, no less. But even with that chuckle in mind, I do have to say that some of those places, some of those sites, did in fact feel holy to me. I think I told you late last summer in a sermon about being out on the Sea of Galilee in the evening, and that for a period of time, as the boat engines were turned off and we were floating quietly on the water at dusk, I had this feeling of wonder and awe at the idea that I was actually in a place where Jesus probably had been. A holy place. At other times, at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, for example, I had a harder time feeling the holiness as people stood in line and priests kept a close eye on the tourists, waving them into the small enclosed space for a few moments before indicating that the line should move along. As I think about those holy site experiences, it occurs to me that for us, for those of us in the Anabaptist stream of faith, for brethren folks, and I think this is true for Mennonites as well, holy places are less likely to be defined by structures than by locations. We have no cathedrals or temples or monuments. There's no Church of the First Baptism by the Ader River. No Mac Cathedral. Instead, what we have, what maybe most distinctively and most universally passes for most of us as holy sites or holy places, are church camps. Why is that? I think it's because there's something about church camp in our tradition that feels more long-standing and more broadly experienced and more spiritually grounded, no pun intended, than just about any other place or experience that is commonly held among us. Our annual conference moves around every year. Our National Youth Conference will be experienced only once in a lifetime for most young people in the church. Our denominational headquarters sits just off the interstate in a city for which I have affection because I once lived there, but for most in our denomination is not a familiar place, nor one held with particular fondness. But camp? There are camps everywhere across the denomination, and attachment to such places is something that is, I think, broadly shared. For many, the memory and feeling of going to church camp is a treasured one. Camp has symbolized for us creation and community and tradition. Camp is air and sky and trees and water. Camp is more than congregation. It's a wider circle of friendship and kinship. It's district and denomination. It's people you looked up to and campfires and Bibles held open on your knees and nature and learning to separate a little from home and making new friends and deepening your faith. At least that's the way I felt. Camp was holy ground because where I went to camp, at Camp Blue Diamond in Middle Pennsylvania, it was one of those places where all those things happened. But it was a holy place, first of all, because of the way the forest surrounded you. And that helped to make the camp feel more separate, more removed from the regular world, the regular routines. You felt it even before you got there. As you approached the camp, a narrow, winding road canopied by towering trees ran through miles of forest as it led you further and further into a different world. And in that different world, in that place of difference where the regular routines of home and of school and of church fade away, at camp there were offered new moments of spiritual awareness and community building, gifts of music and ritual and encounters with the natural world, and the intensity of getting to know these new friends in a special place over a relatively short time. It felt like each moment and each day and each experience and each person mattered. And there's something sacred about that. And so the place where that took place was sacred. Out of curiosity, I pulled my Brethren Encyclopedia off the shelf this week and looked up camping movement, and I found the entry fascinating. This is part of what it said. Although Brethren in Colorado held mountain outings for youth as early as the 1890s, organized camping programs for the Church of the Brethren emerged from youth conferences and summer assemblies held circa 1916 to 1925. One of the earliest was at Beatrice, Nebraska in 1917, organized by Edgar E. Rothrock and Virgil C. Fennell. Districts began to purchase sites for these conferences, with the Sunday School Association of Western Pennsylvania leading the way in December 1923 for Camp Harmony. Camp Laverne in Southern California began in 1924, and Camp Alexander Mack in Indiana in 1925. Young people provided the impetus for Camp Sugar Grove in Southern Ohio in 1926, and Camp Bethel in Virginia in 1927. By 1929, a pattern of roving denominational leadership had been established, with a group of young men known as the Four Horsemen, Dan West, Perry Rohrer, Alvin Brightville, and C.H. Schamberger, traveling by auto from camp to camp. The youth department of the Board of Religious Education provided travel funds and salaries. The decade of the 1930s saw a proliferation of summer camps across the denomination. There was a marked increase in the number of sessions, the number of campers attending, and the various types of camps. Various age groups were represented. In the Western districts, summer assemblies attended by entire families with programs designed for specific age groups were common. By the end of the 1930s, 15 permanent camps reported 60 sessions and 6,280 campers. The article went on to note that centralized leadership was important to the rapid growth of the camping program denominationally from the 1930s through the 1960s. And also that in that time, special conferences about camping were held, and the annual conference made statements about the camping mission and movement. By the 1970s, about the time that I started going to camp, the article noted that Christian education, leadership development, and biblical and theological perspectives on environmental concerns were the key themes for the camping experiences. The influence of young persons as leaders and participants continued to be significant across the decades. In fact, many of my first camp counselors were persons who weren't more than 5 or 10 years older than I was at the time. And the people who were influential for me, who were my camp counselors, were almost all Manchester College students who came to be camp counselors at that camp in Middle Pennsylvania for several summers in a row. Those young adults were important. What they taught and what they modeled was important. The other campers and the friendships we made were important. The songs we sang and the rituals we repeated were important. The experiences, all of that was important. But you know, as I look back, what I think was probably most important to me, it was the place. Yes, all those people who were influential for me were there, and all those important things happened there. But it was the place itself, the holy place that somehow got into my mind and into my heart, and that even now resides not just in memory, but in a tangible feeling of connectedness every time I go back to that place. What remains for me a holy place, holy ground. Maybe some of you have the same intense emotional, even spiritual attachment to this place. So back to where I started. What defines holy ground? What defines a holy place? Is it what happened there, an event, a moment of God presence or God revelation, like what Moses experienced with the burning bush? Is ground hallowed by tragedy, by epiphany? Does a holy place require a building or a monument to mark the spot? And I would add this question. Is a place made holy because somehow there is a sense that in some special way, God is extra present there? In the scripture for this morning, there's a push-pull in regard to holy places. And whether or not God does dwell or can dwell among us, that is, whether God's holiness can be held or contained or more intensely felt in any earthly place, in any earthly dwelling. Solomon, who has built the temple for Israel, this place where the Ark of the covenant between God and God's people, can finally reside, can finally rest, presides over a moment during the temple dedication when a cloud of smoke representing God's holy presence fills the temple. But then, just moments later, it seems, Solomon makes it clear that he recognizes that God cannot be contained in a place or a structure. He declares, "But will God indeed dwell on the earth? Even heaven and highest heaven cannot contain you, God, much less this house that I have built." The temple has God's presence, but cannot contain God. So why build it? Because humans need holy places. We need markers. We need ground upon which we can stand and say, this is the place. This is the place where something holy has happened. This is the place where something holy will happen. Now, there's a bit of a rub in the matter of humans desiring holy places. And the rub has to do with what happens when a holy place evolves into my holy place. That is, what happens when the desire to experience God's presence shifts into a desire to possess God's presence. It's that thing that catches us when we start talking about my camp, or my church, or my place. And rather than the God who comes to us, we begin to imagine the God who belongs to us. To whom does the holy place, the holy ground, belong? I'm not sure I would have thought much about that except for an opportunity on that trip that I was talking about earlier to be at the Western Wall in Jerusalem, a place where different religious needs and commitments and convictions about stories and sacredness all converge, might even say collide, in a particularly sacred place. We went to see the wall on a Friday evening. As we walked through the old city of Jerusalem, Muslims were headed one direction toward evening prayers at Al-Haram al-Sharif, what Jews would call the Temple Mount, because it sits on the site of the ancient temple. But Muslims name as the noble sanctuary because on it sits the Mosque al-Aqsa and the Dome of the Rock. So Muslims were headed there, and meanwhile Jews were headed in the other direction toward the Western Wall, and tourists like us were mixed in. It was the end of Ramadan, so it was a particularly intense time. At the wall itself, we had to pass a military checkpoint to get into the surrounding area. Certain people were allowed in, and others were not. Ultra-conservative Jews practiced certain forms and rituals of prayer. Israeli military training units danced and sang. Women were separated from men for prayers in a smaller section. Religious monitors watched for people filming or taking pictures and hurriedly approached offenders. It was a busy and intense and ritualized place. It was clear who had access and who did not by the makeup of the crowd there at the wall of the ancient temple. The scripture for this morning has an interesting twist on the matter of holiness, possession, place, and God presence. Solomon has built the temple for the chosen people of God, but in this dedication time, recorded in these verses from 1 Kings, he prays a very interesting prayer at the end of the scripture that John read for us. Hear the plea of your servant and of your people Israel when they pray toward this place. O hear in heaven your dwelling place, heed and forgive. Likewise, Solomon continues his prayer, when a foreigner who is not of your people Israel comes from a distant land, because of your name, for they shall hear of your great name, your mighty hand, and your outstretched arm. When a foreigner comes and prays toward this house, then hear in heaven your dwelling place, and do according to all that foreigner calls to you, so that all the peoples of the earth may know your name and fear you, as do your people Israel, and so that they may know that your name has been invoked on this house that I have built. Solomon knows that God does not live in the temple, cannot be contained in the temple, and that the temple is only a symbol for God's holy presence. But he also knows that people need a place to kneel, a place to know that God is somehow in the world, a place to focus their pleas and their prayers. And Solomon also knows that the depth of such need is such that again and again, when we turn to God, we will all too often turn away from the stranger, the foreigner, and the alien. In focusing on what we need from God, we will act like the small child who does not want to share his or her parents' lap. Don't do that, Solomon says. There's more room in God's presence than you imagine. God is here, yes, but not only here. God is here for you, yes, but not only for you. Rather, God comes in ways and to places beyond our particular way and place. God makes sacred the spaces where you and others have encountered God or discovered God or were reborn to God. Give thanks for that and make space for the next person with the same need. I've been here in Indiana for 15 years now. I've been to this camp, Camp Mack, any number of times. But I have to tell you that I have never felt particularly the holiness of this place. I wondered about that as I was writing this sermon. Maybe it's because I have yet to feel that there is space here for me to experience it as my camp, my holy ground. Is it time for that to change? Maybe it's past time. And what helps me to think about that is that the testimony of those of you young people, my own daughter included, who are growing up loving this place, growing up coming here and finding God here and making friends here and growing in faith here. Your testimony of your experience here is what makes this place holy. And the way you open your hearts to God and God's creation here is what might finally open this space to me as well as holy ground, as a holy place. For in some very special way, God is here. With the sky above us, the water before us, the trees around us, the ground under our feet. This is God's holy place.